This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can now grab as a podcast or download off our website at progressive.org. Today, I have a historical figure right here in the studio with me, John Dean of Watergate fame, Nixon's former White House counsel, who warned the president that there was a cancer on the presidency, and who then testified against Nixon in the Watergate hearings. He wrote a book about the Nixon scandal called Blind Ambition. He's written several other books since. John Dean now has a new book out, well, not so new, I guess a 2004 book called Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. And he's testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee in favor of Russ Feingold's censure proposal. John Dean, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt. Nice to be here.
Oh, it's real interesting to meet you and to talk with you here.
Actually, I was accused of being at Senator Feingold's hearing to promote Worse Than Watergate by one of the minority members, which was dead wrong.
A late promotion of that book at that. Tell me what your lasting impressions are of Richard Nixon now.
Well, he's, in a way, he's a comic figure. In other ways, he's a tragic figure. And I have a memory of a very complex man in my locked in my synapses.
How long did you work for him?
1,000 days.
Well, there you go.
1,000 days, and it was a when you listen to the tapes today of Nixon, you realize he had a different personality with different people. He would be one person with his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman. He'd be somebody else with Henry Kissinger. He'd be somebody else with me. And it's really quite interesting that he put these different. He had these different persona. He was always easy to work with for me, no problem.
Did that suggest to you that he didn't know exactly who he was?
That's a real possibility. I don't think he ever had great administrative skills for the presidency. That's why he had someone like Bob Haldeman as chief of staff. And he was slow to interact with his staff. I was there a long time before I started having regular dealings with him. And it was very stiff. It was almost kind of like walking on a set of an Oval Office, if you will, when I used to first go in. But by the time our relationship moves along, I'd walk in and find him with his feet on the desk, and he'd be talking to me around his shoes. So, as I say, he was uneasy. In fact, one of the interesting things about Nixon, we had to prepare something called talking papers anytime we brought someone in the office to meet the president. And because this man had zero gift for gab, you literally had to put the purpose of the meeting, who the person was, and why the meeting was occurring, and so on and so forth. But at the bottom of the memo, you had to have a few sentences to sort of like buzzwords or thoughts that he could start a conversation with this person, because he wasn't very good at this sort of small talk. So, if it wasn't there, there were Alex Butterfield, who ushered more people into the office than anyone else, told me, he said, occasionally when he was confronted with somebody where he didn't have this, he was literally speechless.
So, and Butterfield was the guy who surfaced the tapes first, right?
He's the one who indeed corroborated the fact that there were tapes. I had speculated in my testimony that I thought I was taped, and it's the only speculation I put in that Senate testimony back in 1973. And thank God I did, because when they were trying to discredit my testimony, they said, well, you know, they actually had a system where they fanned out and interviewed, you know, all kinds of people. And they were doing it by the minority staff to try to discredit the witnesses. They didn't want to, you know, have their testimony stand up. And so they called Butterfield in and they said, you know, Dean made this amazing statement that he believed he was recorded. Now, isn't that impossible? And Butterfield said, no, I think he's probably right. He doesn't know it, but Butterfield knew how few people knew about the taping system. But I think he was right. And what had made me aware of the fact I was being taped was Nixon's behavior late in the game, when he literally goes to the corner of his hideaway office and starts whispering around the potted palm in the office and saying, "I was foolish to do this," or "I made a mistake when I did that." And I said, "This man, John, is recording you. He just wasn't very good at that sort of thing."
He was talking to the tape.
Yes.
Did you ever speak with Nixon after he resigned?
Never did. I think it would have been very difficult for him. I'm not the only one who never spoke to him. I know John Ehrlichman never talked to him. John Ehrlichman was his chief domestic advisor. Bob Haldeman and he had sort of parted the way. They did patch up before both men passed away, but that Nixon would have had great difficulty dealing with me at that point, because it was surprising. He said he was very flattering in one sense in his memoirs about me. When he started dealing with me, he said, "Well, you know, he'd written in his diary, you know, this got this bright young guy and so on and so forth, some nice stuff." But then he says I was obviously a traitor for breaking rank and trying to blow everything up, trying to save him.
Yeah, how have you dealt with that accusation?
It doesn't bother me at all, because everybody for whom I had any respect, I told what I was going to do before I did it. And I said, "Listen, I'm not going to lie for anybody. And it's just not that way. So plan your life around that." And then when I said I was going to go to the prosecutors, after I'd tried to tell the president that he was in deep trouble, as you alluded to, the so-called cancer on the presidency conversation, after that, people knew where I stood. And I actually had the support of some of my colleagues who said, "Do it." And, you know, in one sense, what my plan was, and one of the reasons I broke rank, is I thought that my colleagues would do the right thing, that they would stand up and tell the truth and it would end it. And Nixon himself might save himself by coming forward and saying, "Yeah, I made some bad mistakes and here's what I did." What it did is just escalated the cover up to the point where he had no option other than to finally resign or be impeached.
I mean, some people think he could have saved his presidency by, even at those 11th hour, 11th and a half hours, by coming forward, apologizing, and getting everything out.
Well, Americans like to give their president, if not their representative or senator, the benefit of the doubt. And if you look at the poll numbers, people knew Nixon was deeply involved in Watergate and stayed with him, even those who might not have voted for him for a long time. So it's a natural tendency.
Did you ever speak with Haldeman or Ehrlichman afterwards, and what was that like if you did?
Both of them I ran into. Haldeman I had talked to because I happened to run into him in an office building he was working in. We talked about getting together for lunch. We were friendly. We never happened, and he died shortly thereafter. Both Haldeman and Ehrlichman died relatively young. They were in their early late 60s, early 70s when they passed away. Haldeman, for example, he was a Christian Scientist, and he got stomach cancer. And he could have been treated, but decided because of his religious beliefs he was not going to even take treatment. And sort of went that way, which was rather, notwithstanding his family trying to get him to take some health treatments and deal with it, he didn't want to.
And Ehrlichman came around partly to understanding that Nixon had done something terribly wrong, didn't he?
He did. He pointed the finger at Nixon, and it actually, his defense for a lot of his actions was sort of a Nuremberg defense, where he said, "Well, I was just following orders." And so he had no doubt in his mind, nor did Haldeman. Both of them actually realized that they had broken the law by the time it was all over.
Mm-hmm. Speaking with John Dean, I'm very interested in the comparisons you draw between Nixon and Bush. Could you lay out some of those? Because they don't seem obvious at the top, because Nixon so bad in social relations and social graces and inability to make small talk, whereas, you know, that's Bush's calling card.
Well, as I write a regular column, when I promised myself when I turned 60, which I did several years ago now that I would return to writing, which I enjoy. I'd had a successful career in business, so I could do it, and I have done it. And I do a biweekly column for an organization called Fine Law, which is run by a large legal publishing operation. And I started writing, when Bush came into office, I started writing columns about the Bush presidency. I'd been writing the column several years before that, but I was stunned at the secrecy of the administration, and I was also surprised that no one in the major media was writing about it. And I knew that there's just no good that comes out of secrecy. So I began looking closely at Bush and finding these striking Nixonian features of this presidency. It's almost as if we'd left an old playbook in the basement. They found it, dusted it off, and said, this stuff looks pretty good. We ought to give it a try. As I dug in and still had some pretty good sources within that presidency, I found that really the principal mover and shaker of this presidency is clearly Dick Cheney. But let me focus on your question of the similarities between Bush and Nixon, which are not readily apparent. I've discovered that both men, when you look at them, learned about the presidency from men they greatly respect. Richard Nixon from Dwight Eisenhower, George Bush from his father, Bush won. When both men became president, you get the very distinct impression that they don't feel that they quite fit in the shoes of the person about whom they learned the presidency. And Nixon, for example, would constantly be going down to Key Biscayne, San Clemente. He'd be out on the road and just was very uneasy. Or up at Camp David, he just didn't like being in the Oval Office. And I saw this same pattern in George Bush, who is constantly away from the Oval Office itself. The other striking similarity is both men talk in the third person about the office of the president as if it's just unusual. It's like the royal we, if you will. You look at other presidents like, say, Reagan or Clinton, who clearly filled that office. In fact, you almost had to pry Clinton out of the office when his term was over. And Reagan, despite whatever weaknesses he had intellectually, certainly, you know, filled the role of president and was playing the role to the hilt and enjoying it. So this was a very Nixonian sort of a distance from the office. The other thing is, of course, the way they've set up the White House, the structures, the secrecy, and, of course, not merely reviving the imperial presidency, but expanding it beyond Nixon's wildest dream.
I'm speaking with John Dean. You're listening to the Progressive Radio Show. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of that magazine. You know, Nixon had a kind of insane paranoid streak to him and was threatening to firebomb the Brookings Institution, or late at night, I think he speculated about bombing Capitol Hill even. I mean, we don't get that sense of paranoia from Bush, or do you?
Well, the reason I wrote a book with the title Worse Than Watergate and was very cautious in using that title given my knowledge of Watergate was that there's a real difference. When you look at what's happening today and what happened during Watergate, nobody died as a result of the so-called abuses of power during Nixon's presidency. You might make the exception of, say, the secret bombing of Cambodia, but that never really got into the Watergate litany per se. I'm talking about that really falls in that sort of historical chapter where they list, you know, what the abuses were. You look at Bush's abuses and Cheney's. To me, it's a Bush/Cheney presidency. And today people are dying as a result of abuse of power. That's much more serious.
Dying in Iraq?
Dying in Iraq. God knows where they're dying, in secret prisons. To me, the fact that a vice president could go to Capitol Hill and lobby for torture is just unbelievable. just unbelievable. The fact that a small clique of attorneys in the Department of Justice could write, how do we get around the Geneva Convention so we can torture during interrogations, is just, I can't even get there mentally. And when you read their briefs, they didn't get there mentally either.
It is shocking what these guys have gotten away with. Talk a little bit more about Cheney, because the subtitle of this book is The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, but I think the actual one would be The Secret Presidency of Dick Cheney. You call him co-president in this book.
I really do, and they really are. I had, as I say, some very, very good sources within this White House, and they I did this book at a time. I actually wrote it in 2003 before anyone was paying any attention to any of these issues that have now surfaced in the major media.
I mean, the amazing thing is it came out before the NSA scandal
right,
and appeared or the Valerie Plame scandal blew up.
Absolutely. They just keep walking into my title and adding what could be for even additional chapters. But in other words, the base material is what I covered and sort of the mentality. But what happened is, and it was evident really at the time of the transition in 2000 after the election, when Cheney is very confident that they're going to win at the Supreme Court, and they're deep into planning the White House and how it's going to be structured. I've got some friends who are in there, and they're telling me what's happening, and they said, you know, Bush doesn't have a clue what's going on. Cheney's setting this thing up the way he wants it. He's designing a National Security Council that'll probably be more powerful than the statutory National Security Council under Condoleezza Rice, and it was, and it is. I mean, she was the perfect foil for him because he can roll over her anytime he wants to and does. And even putting her states even better, leaving less problems, having to keep her out on the road, and so it's the Cheney Rumsfeld connection has really just been driving the foreign policy from day one.
Why do you think Bush divested so much of his power to this man?
Bush had expertise in one thing, and that was how to run a presidential campaign. He understands campaign and presidential politics. He has no interest or disposition, or I think probably he's not stupid, but he's not bright. He's not a rocket scientist either. He isn't interested in policy. Cheney is the opposite. He loves this stuff. He's a wonk, and he gets into it, and he's had very strong feelings about issues that he's held for a long time, and he has been determined. And in fact, when I testified in front of Senator Feingold's committee, I said, I can't find in history any other presidency that's made it a matter of policy to expand presidential powers. What we've done in the past is they've been expanded because of an issue or a reason to expand them. This presidency, it's the reason alone.
And Cheney has bragged to Bob Woodward about that.
Absolutely.
That's been his goal, to restore it to its status prior to Watergate, or
absolutely,
prior to Iran-Contra and all of that. Tell me about the Feingold hearing. First of all, your response to Feingold's suggestion, proposal on censure.
Well, I'd been invited several times over the last decade or more to testify before Congress, and I've always politely found a way not to do it.
Why is that, John Dean?
Well, I knew it was going to make a certain sensation, my first return to after giving my Senate testimony during Watergate, that it would be a little bit of a media event for my appearing there. So I thought it should be an issue that was important. It should be an issue that I felt strongly about. And when Senator Feingold invited me to appear on his censure resolution, I thought this is a very good issue because I think that if I appeared not as a partisan. I think my partisan days are really long behind me.
Identify yourself politically right now?
I registered as an independent, and I vote for as many Democrats as I do Republicans. I really look at the person and how they, or the issue and what's involved, and try to come out with I really am a centrist in many ways. I don't fly on either wing, if you will. But anyway, so I didn't go as a partisan and made that very clear, but I thought the issue was important. I explained how a lot of baggage is connected with censure, but how important it was that the Senate do something, because he's addressing really a blatant violation of law, the violation of the Foreign Intelligence Security Act, FISA. And the president, you know, when Lincoln, for example, suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War, he went to Congress to seek permission after the fact. You know, all the things that Lincoln did when he pushed the envelope, he got permission after the fact. We have a president who says, screw that, I'm just going to do it. And it's sort of an in-your-face attitude. And he's rolling over the prerogatives of the Congress. I noticed that Senator Specter, the chairman of the committee, has now said, well, I want to get I'm going to do something about this more than the censure, in a sense. He's now talking about withdrawing funding for NSA unless they report to the Senate what they're doing.
I mean, it is amazing the violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that Bush has been committing, and he's acknowledged that he's just not going to go that route. You made a famous comment, I think it should be famous anyway, when he said that. You said this is the first time that a president has actually confessed to an impeachable offense.
It's exactly what he did. Richard Nixon was one of the provisions in his bill of impeachment, in the article of impeachment, was his warrantless surveillance of NSA and media people, which is now covered directly by the FISA law. And so the House made it very clear that warrantless wiretapping is an impeachable offense. And so, I mean, it couldn't be any clearer.
The other thing you call a possible impeachable offense in your book is the possibility, to my mind, the likelihood that Bush lied this country into war, into the Iraq war, made so many misleading and deceitful comments that he should be impeached for that. Is that still your position?
I'm convinced, as I deconstructed his statements, particularly his State of the Union, just before the Iraq War.
This is in January 2003, then.
Right. And when I took the key core of that speech and looked at even the available information then, that if anyone had done any sort of research at all, that it was clear that the representations he was making to the Congress as fact were not fact. Now, is that lying? It certainly is a form of distortion. And this is the highest point in a presidency in his relationship with the Congress, is when he reports the State of the Union. And this is a crime to lie to Congress. The way he did it in the follow-up procedures, he actually belittled the Congress in many ways and sending them bogus material. It was really quite stunning when one peels it all apart. And I said, is there any question in my mind this is an impeachable offense? No, because back in the Nixon proceeding, the secret Cambodia bombing became an issue. And that probably would have been considered an impeachable offense, but for the fact it turned out not to be secret. Nixon had briefed all of the key ranking and chairmen of the relative committees that had jurisdiction over all those issues. They'd been told in advance what he was doing in Cambodia. So you can't say the Congress didn't know that he was bombing in Cambodia.
Though I think members of the House Judiciary Committee back then were considering or drafting articles along those lines and decided not to make them one of the three articles.
They also did legal research and determined that there was no question that based on a lot of the state conventions and the founders' words, that misrepresentation to the Congress, the House or Senate, was to be an impeachable offense.
I'm speaking with John Dean. You're listening to Progressive Radio. When I go around and talk about impeachment, people usually respond by saying, it's impossible, it's politically impossible. The New York Times editorialized on censure against that and against impeachment, calling impeachment a fairy tale. I saw a poll that said 33% of Americans are in favor of impeachment. Is that a high number or a low number where we are versus where things were with Nixon? And how do you respond to people who just say it's never going to happen?
Well, I think there's a political reality about impeachment, that clearly it is a very political process. It is purely a political process. Yes, there are some definitions of high crimes and misdemeanors and treason and bribery that are in the Constitution, but the interpretation of that language is purely political. It can reach line about sex in the Oval Office, it can reach a long way, that clause.
Yeah, we saw that.
We saw that. We know that, which was an absurd use of the impeachment clause. It is the big canon, and as long as the same party that controls the Congress is in the White House, it just isn't going to happen unless, I'm not even sure if a president murdered his wife, they would impeach him. It's too political. But I think that those who are focusing on this issue are raising important questions. And one of the reasons I thought it was important that a censure resolution was appropriate was I thought back, if somebody had censured Nixon or even a resolution of either House or Senate to say, listen, what you're doing is unacceptable to the Congress, that shot across the bow might have straightened him up. And I wish it still can, Feingold's censure resolution get more traction, it might provide us all some safety because there's two more years left of this presidency. But one more thing. Mm-hmm. If there's a good possibility in November, the House or Senate are going to go to the Democrats. And it's going to be hell for this presidency for the last 2 years, and they've earned it. And that's when impeachment could become a true reality. I'd settle for oversight, but impeachment's not out of the question.
That's why I think if things get hotter, and if Democrats get control of the House, for instance, that censure may become attractive to Bush if he's got any sense, because it would be a way for him to, put a lid on this cauldron.
It's not a bad idea because they have supplied a steady diet of material. And as I say, I think it'll be 2 years of executive privilege fights, and the subpoena will change the complexion of the oversight.
John Dean, your testimony, which I read before the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Feingold censure hearing, you testified that this is the first time that you actually have feared our government. That struck me. Why is that?
Now, I don't frighten easily. I understand the government. I find it frightening because I think that Dick Cheney knows no limits. He's got the only person Cheney reports to is George Bush. He works behind closed doors. He is I just know from little tidbits I'm picking up from friends who have to be careful not to speak out of school that there's probably more covert activity both abroad and even maybe here in the United States than there has been in decades going on because of this so-called war on terror.
Do you fear for our democratic system?
I fear for the system. I fear for the system. And I fear that for our liberties, because only a small group of people fight for our liberties. And once we start on the slippery slope and those people are put in jeopardy, then we're really in trouble.
I think we're going to have to end it there. John Dean, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.